I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A recent study by the Pew Charitable Trusts found that in 2016, Philadelphia had 232,000 foreign-born residents, representing about 15% of the city's population. In fact, immigration has been the main reason that the city has been gaining residents over years, or I should say after years of population decline. The fastest-growing group of foreign-born Philadelphians, according to Pew, are from Africa, while people born in Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean represent the largest groups. This has brought some much-needed revitalization to the city and has meant that there are more residents who speak limited or no English. Today in Radio Times, how the city is serving the needs of residents who are not proficient in English and what the schools are doing to help students for whom English is a foreign language. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Orlando Almonte is the Language Access Program Manager for the Philadelphia Office of Immigrant Affairs. Orlando Almonte, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us, Nelson Flores, and he's an Associate Professor of Educational Linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. He's also the primary investigator of the Philadelphia Bilingual Education Project. Nelson Flores, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And to our listeners, you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me begin with you, if I could, Orlando. Help us understand in Philadelphia how many residents are what we would think of as either non-English speakers or not fluent in English?
Sure. With some of the census data that we have indicates that about 10.4% or a little bit over 10% of our residential Philadelphia population is considered limited English proficient. That comes up to about 151,000 people in Philadelphia, so not an insignificant amount.
And limited. I mean, this is all very, can be very subjective. What does that mean? Does it mean they have some language, no language, a mix of?
Sure. So the census actually defines it as speaking English less than very well. And for the purposes of, you know, our program and what we're trying to do with the city, I like to explain it as it could mean that someone is able to speak enough English to maybe pay their water bill. But not enough English to dispute their water bill if they needed to, right?
Oh, well, that's an interesting way to frame it. How many different languages, and we should also add the dialects in Philadelphia?
There's not a definitive amount because the census doesn't even collect very specific data after a certain number of languages. But we have data from the services that we rely on citywide that indicate over 80 or 90 different languages across the city on any given fiscal year.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot.
And that includes dialects as well.
And are there certain parts of the city where you're going to see more non-English speakers?
Yeah, and it really varies by neighborhood and by language. In North Philadelphia, you know, Spanish is all over, but primarily in North Philadelphia, we have very heavy concentrations. Parts of South Philadelphia, Chinatown is obvious, some parts of Southwest. The Northeast in particular is an area where we've seen a lot of growth in not just limited English proficiency, but in the diversity of languages that we see in that area, especially like Oxford Circle and in the deep Northeast.
So in very significant parts of the city, we're seeing this. Nelson, let me turn to you, and let's talk a little bit about the school population. Does that represent largely what Orlando was telling us about the city population?
Yes. Yeah, so the average in school district of Philadelphia is about 10%, 11% English language learner, depending on the year.
Depending on the year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously it fluctuates depending on the school year and I guess where children and families are moving around. And again, a real mix of languages?
Yes, a mix of languages, the top being Spanish, but then some of the other prominent ones being Chinese, Khmer, Vietnamese, and Arabic.
And Arabic as well. Mm-hmm. Are there certain schools that have more diverse language-speaking students than others?
Well, as Orlando was saying, I think it's about the neighborhoods. And so in North Philadelphia, most of the English learners are Spanish speakers. South Philadelphia is much more diverse. So for Ness in South Philadelphia, over 50% of the students are English language learners, and there are over 20 languages represented there.
Wow.
So there's a range. And then there are some schools that have no English learners because the demographics of those neighborhoods just don't have that population.
Well, let me go back to you, Orlando. What can the city or what does the city do to help people who don't speak English?
I'm glad you bring that up because in May of 2016, Mayor Kenney actually signed Executive Order 716, which launched Language Access Philly, and it's a citywide program where my office, my program and the Office of Immigrant Affairs works with city departments to ensure that they're providing their services in other languages, either through interpretation services, telephone interpretation, translating documents, having bilingual staff, and really making sure that departments have a written plan and a policy. You know, they can't turn people away because of their inability to speak English, so how are you going to serve them?
How do you serve, though, 80 different languages?
Exactly, and that's something I try to really stress to some departments. We're never going to have bilingual employees that speak every language, and literally any language can come across your desk at any given time. We rely heavily on telephone interpretation service, which is an on-demand 24/7 service that we can call in and get virtually any language over the phone within a reasonable amount of time, usually a couple of seconds. Some of the rare languages we do have some trouble with, but primarily we rely heavily on contracted vendors and other services to be able to bridge that gap.
The people at the other end of the phone that can say, this is what this person is saying.
Yes, exactly.
So someone calls 911 in a non-English language, they can be helped.
Exactly. And actually, 911 and the police department is actually one of our larger users of the service because of the amount of volume they see, because of the they actually see a bunch of different languages at any given time. And so that's something that my program is, reviewing every couple of months and trying to see how we can help make the service, be a bit quicker, more convenient, trying to identify trends in languages. It's interesting stuff.
Let me turn back to you, Nelson. Let's talk more about schools. You were actually an English as a second language teacher for a couple of years in New York and also a year here in Philadelphia. There are different approaches in the classroom. Walk us through them, and let's start with ESL.
Correct. So ESL is a model where English is the primary language that's used in the classroom, and there are different ways of doing it. There is a pull-out where the ESL teacher pulls students out of the classroom and gives them language instruction that they need in order to be successful in the classroom. And then there's a co-teaching or push-in model where the ESL teacher goes into the classroom and actually supports students in the classrooms. So those are the two major models of ESL instruction that exist in Philadelphia but also exist around the country.
And which one did you do? Were you a pull-out or?
I did a little bit of both, which is actually very common in schools. And in Philadelphia, what they try to do is at lower levels, they try to do, at the lower grades, I should say, they try to focus more on co-teaching as the model. And as students are older and coming in and may have more needs, they try to move more towards pull-out. And so ESL teachers at these schools are oftentimes doing a little bit of both. They're doing co-teaching and they're doing pull-out. And that was what I did. And that's very common in many schools where you're trying to meet the needs of students who have a range of proficiencies. Because remember, in schools, we're talking about English language learners as in a somewhat different way than we're talking about it for language access, where it's not just about being able to defend yourself in your water bill. It's about being able to engage with grade-level content. And so you have students who have been in the country for 5-6 years who may still be ESL students or English language learners because they're not able to meet grade-level content standards. And so English language learner means something a little different in schools. And so you have those students, and then you have students who are new to the country who aren't even able to communicate yet in the language. And ESL teachers and bilingual teachers are oftentimes working with both of those sets of students in the same classrooms.
Because for students, not only do they have to learn English, they have to master the materials, right?
Correct.
And that's really a sort of a two-step process in a way.
Correct. And they're happening at the same time for these students and for the teachers that are working with them.
Now, there's bilingual education. What is that? I mean, how does that compare to ESL then?
So there are two major models of bilingual education. One is a transitional model where the home language of students is used usually for 1 to 3 years as a bridge to English, and then students are mainstreamed. They're exited from the program. And then there are dual language bilingual programs, and those programs, the goals are different. The goals are for students to graduate, exit from these programs when they leave elementary school or middle school, or even high school, proficient in being able to read, write, and communicate in both languages. And the difference, another difference between dual language and transitional is that those models are oftentimes open to students who are coming from homes where English is the primary language. And so it's kind of an enrichment program for those students, while it's also helping students who are learning English to also maintain their home languages.
We were talking about this before going on the air about, you know, why people coming to this country would not learn English. And one of the things, Orlando, you said is, it's really hard to learn another language.
Yeah, and I love to tell the story about my mom. I mean, growing up, I was like the de facto interpreter for my family. In many ways, I still am, because my family has a hard time navigating government, because my family has a hard time understanding a lot of the complicated things that we take for granted in English. But it's hard. My mother has been in this country for over 30 years now and has tried to learn English multiple times. But raising a family at the same time, or working, 40 to 60 hours a week and raising a family, there's not enough time. There weren't enough resources. And the times where she was able to sign up for classes, she just had an incredibly difficult time at an older age to learn English.
But I would think if you're sort of surrounded by English, that over time you would at least appropriate a certain sort of rudimentary way of speaking English. Does that not happen?
It varies by individual. Fortunately for my mother, she never had to learn a bunch of English. We grew up in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, a heavily Hispanic city in New Jersey. There's Spanish radio stations. Her employers spoke Spanish. So in a sense, yeah, she was surrounded by English, but she was also surrounded by Spanish. And so she never really had a huge need to learn, even though she wanted to, though, and she still really wants to this day.
But kind of a closed community.
Exactly.
There. Does that make sense to you, Nelson?
Yes, and I think, as we were talking about before the program, too, I think another challenge for adults is that they're taking care of families and they are working and they're doing a lot of other things that children aren't. So children are in school the whole day, for most of the day, and have the opportunity to be exposed to the language in ways that adults oftentimes don't. And so I think it leads to a misconception that adults just aren't good language learners. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's more about adults don't have the opportunity because they're adults and they're doing a lot of other things.
And are you two an example of what happens to the children, which is the children learn English probably through school and then become the family translator? Is that true for you, Nelson?
Well, my family was a bilingual family, so both of my parents spoke English and Spanish. What happened with my family, which I think is common for other families, is that many of my siblings don't necessarily feel comfortable using Spanish. And I use Spanish because I studied it in school, and then I traveled abroad, and I become more comfortable with Spanish. But a common phenomenon in the United States is language shift over the generations. And so the first generation typically, the parents are much more comfortable in the language other than English. The second generation, typically, children may be bilingual, but maybe more comfortable in English. And by the third generation student, they're just English speakers, and they lost the language.
Almost having a break here. Orlando, is that your story as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely more comfortable with English than with Spanish, although I technically learned Spanish first. My mother doesn't speak English, so I learned Spanish first. But I'm more comfortable speaking English. But I think the reverse is true for my family. Most of my siblings speak English really well, but we never really made that connection. Like, our family taught us Spanish at a very early age, so we're also really comfortable speaking Spanish.
Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Orlando Almonte, and he is the Language Access Program Manager for Philadelphia's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Also with us, Nelson Flores. He's an Associate Professor of Educational Linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education. He's the primary investigator of the Philadelphia Bilingual Education Project. We're talking about bilingual education, speaking English, much more. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. About 10% of Philadelphians are not fluent in English, just above the national average. We're talking about how Philadelphia city government and the public schools in the city serve this population. Again, Orlando Almonte, Nelson Flores, our guests. And you can join us. Any questions or comments or stories you might have, again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Orlando, let me go back to you. What are the biggest then challenges facing the city in terms of reaching out to these populations?
Well, one of the challenges are that they don't speak English, right? So, exactly. I mean, we've always had a problem reaching communities in general, even in English, but primarily non-English speaking communities are notoriously difficult to get a hold of because they're primarily working class families, because they don't speak English, because they're not typically engaging government. And for a long time, you couldn't access government services in your language. And so they might not even know that it's available. They don't know that, you know, they have the right to services in their language. They don't know that there are policies and plans in place for them to be able to access some of these services.
And to you, Nelson, I'm just curious about when we look at teaching students how to speak English or how to be more fluent in English, are there models that have proved to be effective?
Well, when we look at the research, what the research indicates is that when we look at students over the long term, so how they do by middle school, the most effective model is a dual language bilingual education model, which, as I said before, is a model where the goal is for students to have bilingualism and biliteracy when they graduate. And so students who enter English language learners, who enter those programs as opposed to English-only ESL programs, tend to outperform students who were only in ESL English-only programs. And that may sound counterintuitive to a lot of people. And the reason why that's the case is because students have the opportunity to continue to develop the content knowledge in a language that they understand while they're learning English, which is why that model is in the end, more effective.
And is there a shortage, though, of teachers?
Well, one of the challenges is it's very difficult to find bilingual teachers who have the qualifications to teach. Because just because one is bilingual doesn't mean one has the qualifications to teach bilingually. It certainly has been a challenge in Philadelphia, and it's a challenge nationally. Another challenge, of course, is that many schools have many, many languages, and so it's not necessarily feasible to have a dual language program if you have 20 different languages and have lots of kind of smaller languages out there. But in schools where they have just one language, like Spanish, that really is the model that I think should be implemented when possible.
Well, I'm thinking about that student that might be one of 20 different languages in a school. What do they do if they don't have a teacher who speaks their language? Sink or swim?
Well, there are different strategies that teachers can use to help those students. I mean, there's lots of best practices in terms of how to support language development that teachers can use. But there's also just a stance that teachers can take of seeing language as a resource, seeing bilingualism as a resource, and kind of valuing and acknowledging that these students speak languages that they don't speak. And really positioning the students as teachers in that sense, I think, is a way of valuing the bilingualism of the students, even if you're not able to teach them bilingually because you don't have those language skills. So I think all teachers can do that.
So there might be a classroom discussion and figure out how to sort of pull out that student that might not be so proficient in English, but have them participate in a way?
Right. And when we look at like the Common Core State Standards, for example, one of the things they're asking for students to be able to do is to understand the impact of language on audience. And bilingual, multilingual students are already doing that because they constantly know when I'm speaking to someone who speaks English, I have to use English. When I speak to someone who speaks another language, I have to speak to them in that language. So those students are particularly well situated to understand the impact of language on audience. But oftentimes that's an untapped resource in classrooms.
We call that code switching, don't we? I mean, that's in a way,
yes.
Knowing your audience and knowing how to...
The term that is used in the bilingual, multilingual context has been translanguaging as kind of thinking about kind of crossing borders.
I wonder too, Orlando, whether, I mean, we're talking about the city and we're talking about the schools, but there is crossover, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some crossover. We do work closely with the school district on some initiatives, and especially now that the school district's a bit closer to city government than it has been in quite some time. We do see a difference in languages that we serve, though, and I think that's pretty interesting, and we see some difference by department as well. I think it depends on, again, it goes down by neighborhood. We are able to identify some language trends earlier because usually if a child is going to school, we know that there's some Spanish or some other language that is being introduced and that we weren't familiar with or that we don't particularly serve as much at the city level, but we are seeing more activity at the school level, which is always interesting.
I was reading a study looking at Spanish language students that they had a harder time. I'm looking at you, Nelson, but they had a harder time making that transition to English. How come?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons for that. And I think one is kind of what I was getting to before, where English language learner means something quite different in the school setting than it does in a city kind of access setting, where we're really looking at whether students can engage in grade level content. And so many of the Latino students in Philadelphia tend to be in very segregated, low-income communities, very under-resourced schools, where many of the students at the school are performing below grade level for lots of different reasons that aren't just about language. And so I think that that issue is really a broader issue that's not just about language. And if we think about it just about language, I worry about the narrative that it creates around students.
So they, along with their fellow students, are struggling with things like poverty. Schools that are not meeting their particular needs.
Right. And so that's a broader political kind of economic question that's not just about language. And I think part of the misunderstanding around that is that people who don't work in schools think English learner, and they're thinking someone who can't communicate in English. Most of those students, all of those students probably, by third grade, according to that study, are able to communicate in English. The issue is that they're not being reclassified because they're not meeting grade level standards. But unfortunately, many students in those schools are not, and it's not an indictment of the schools. That there are many other challenges in those communities that we also need to confront and tackle.
We've got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. Another question for you, Orlando, is, has Philadelphia been welcoming to immigrants, broadly speaking?
Oh, I definitely agree. And I mean, it really starts at language access. And I did want to make a note, though, of distinction. Language access goes a bit further than just our immigrant community. We have a very large, limited English proficient Puerto Rican population who are not technically immigrants, but technically citizens and have different challenges that they're facing. So I did want to make that distinction because usually people associate this with just immigrants, but it goes a bit further than that.
But and it's important to remember Puerto Ricans are American citizens.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, it's really important to keep in mind because they're culturally, it's a different set of challenges as well. And there, we face some challenges in trying to raise awareness with how welcoming we are, because every community has its own set of challenges. Has, depending on what country they're immigrating from, have like fears or distrust in government, or, you know, culturally they don't, you know, they're not used to asking for help or, you know, expecting government to help them. So it has been a challenge, but we have been very welcoming in our policies. And the mayor has been very vocal and supportive of immigrants.
Language is more than words. I mean, language is identity, it's culture, it's family, it's history, it's all of those things. You want to speak to that, Nelson?
Yes. I mean, I think that it's very important to recognize that language isn't just about language. And I think also that issues of language inequity are oftentimes connected to broader inequities about poverty, about racism, and that we live in a society that doesn't value, in general, the bilingualism, the multilingualism of students of color, but oftentimes want to promote bilingualism and multilingualism for white students. And I think that that's
something, as a form of enrichment.
As a form of enrichment. And whereas the language, the bilingualism of students of color is typically seen as a challenge that needs to be overcome rather than something that we should build on.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you, and then we'll get some folks to join our conversation. That's Nelson Flores. He's an associate professor of educational linguistics at Penn's Graduate School of Education, and again, the primary investigator of the Philadelphia Bilingual Education Project. Orlando Almonte is the Language Access Program Manager for Philadelphia's Office of Immigrant Affairs. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Dave wondering, Orlando, does Orlando find that the services offered by the city reduces the urgency that residents learn English? I guess the idea of translating materials, does that mean that they are less willing to learn English?
I think it's safe to say from a lot of ESL providers across the city that it is not reducing the urgency. There are wait lists across the city. There, you know, most places can't meet the demand of people trying to learn English. So I don't believe so. And I also think that it takes some time to learn English. And I mentioned a story about my own mother, but you know, people spend a lifetime trying to learn and master a language, and if they're able to, if they have the time to. So I think in the meantime, those people, those residents definitely have the right and should be able to access their government.
But again, broadly speaking, it seems we don't have an official language in this country, but we are largely English speaking. You're going to be better off if you speak English, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of it that way, but a lot of people also would agree that language is important to them culturally. You know, it reminds them where they come from. It's important that their kids learn the language. I think I would be a completely different person if I didn't speak Spanish. And I love speaking Spanish with my family, with some friends occasionally. So it's a part of who I am. So I don't think just because someone necessarily lives here that there's an urgency to kind of learn another language or completely assimilate immediately.
Nelson, I mean, is the goal of either ESL or bilingual education in schools, the goal is to get the students to be proficient in English?
Right. I think the goals of all programs, one of the goals for all of the programs is for students to become proficient in English. And I think the goal of dual language programs is also for students to become proficient and to be able to read and write in a language other than English.
A question from Peter. Is there any program to supplement native language skills so kids or adults don't lose their native language when they learn English? I'm tossing that back to you, Nelson. Do you know of such a thing? Is there any program to supplement native language skills so kids or adults don't lose their native language? I guess the idea that you come here with a language, then you do learn English, but as you both were saying, over time, over generations, they begin to lose that contact with that
language. So I can speak to the K-12 system. Certainly there are models of bilingual education that exist in Philadelphia and exist around the country where the goal is for students to continue to develop those native language skills as they're learning English. I'm not as familiar with the adult ed context in Philadelphia.
Maybe you are, Orlando.
Not that I'm completely aware of, at least not anything that I've formally heard of. I have heard of like speaking circles or language clubs of people trying to maintain some of their language. And I think that's geared more towards people who have learned another language in another country, come back to the States and just trying to keep it. But I do know of people that also participate in those types of the speaking circles or language clubs to try to just not lose some of their language.
Let me get Melissa from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Melissa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm actually also on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Psychology, where several of my colleagues study developmental psycholinguistics. And the point that I wanted to make was simply that we know a great deal about how neural plasticity for language learning, kind of that window begins to close right around puberty. And that doesn't mean it's impossible for adults to learn a new language. Obviously, I learned to speak German when I was in college. But it is, in fact, much, 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 much more difficult for adults to achieve fluency in a new language. And I think that part of the bias in our culture against immigrants is that we look at those adults like your mom, and we think, oh, she's just not trying. She just doesn't want to learn. When in fact, what we know is that cognitively and neurologically, it's simply much more challenging for adults than it is for kids, which is why the ESL and the bilingual education in schools is so incredibly important.
Well, Melissa, you've touched on a bunch of things. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Orlando, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. And I mean, my mother definitely is able to speak some English, but she's also intimidated when speaking English. She's not comfortable. She's not confident. I think she gets really nervous when she's trying to speak English or the very little English that she does know and, you know, kind of just like clams up. So I think it's also, you know, depending on the setting, it's not so difficult to just expect to throw someone in and expect someone to be able to speak that language.
And it's true for a lot of things, Nelson. I mean, children, they're growing, their brains are growing and developing, that is the prime time.
Right. So I'm certainly not a developmental psychologist, but from a linguistic perspective, the major difference that linguists have found between adult and children learners is phonology. That for adults, adults who learn a language will typically have a marked accent when speaking that language in ways that children do not. And that's the major difference, which isn't necessarily one that's about communication per se, right? But oftentimes people who aren't sensitive to the fact that people speak with different accents will oftentimes say they don't understand them or they don't want to make the effort to understand them, when oftentimes it's not about the fact that they can't communicate. It's that they have a marked accent, which then makes them more self-conscious about speaking because people are oftentimes are hostile or condescending to them because they speak with an accent in ways that children who learn a language oftentimes do not.
shows you the complexity of language. A tweet from Victoria: I taught English as a second language for several years, and a secondary problem was that many of my students were also illiterate in their native language. This added a literacy component to the classes that made it harder for older students. This needs addressing. Can I toss that back to you, Nelson?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why bilingual education in general tends to be more effective is precisely because students are developing native native literacy skills, right? And as students come in older, or oftentimes when they have had interrupted instruction because they come from countries that have not the same educational infrastructure, or just educations that didn't give them the type of literacy skills that are needed for to be successful in U.S. education settings, oftentimes they need support in that native language literacy in order to then be able to transfer those skills to the English literacy that they're also developing. And so the research that looks at kind of SIFE students, or students with interrupted formal education, has suggested that a native language literacy component to their education is really important to help them to develop the skills to learn, to read, so that they can then transfer those reading skills to English.
We have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. Orlando, if you could wave your magic wand for the work that you do in Philadelphia, what does the city need?
The city needs to work with communities to raise awareness on the availability of these services. Because I think a lot of departments are doing really good work, have come a long way in the 2.5 years I've been working with the city. But not enough people know that these services are available. If they're not offered services, or if they're unable to reach these services, they also don't know who to go to. Mm-hmm. Because they don't speak English, how do you complain about a service that wasn't offered to you? So that's really like probably my goal for the next year or two, to just really raise awareness to some of these communities. I mean, it's difficult for many of the reasons you guys mentioned. Some people, like some communities, aren't literate in their own language. It's hard to reach these communities. Generally, there's not like a TV channel or a radio show that we can, you know, help raise awareness on. So it's really like grassroots and working with community organizations.
Well, I appreciate both of you coming in and telling us about the work that you do and this important issue of language here in Philadelphia. Thanks so much. Orlando Almonte is the Language Access Program Manager for Philadelphia's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Nelson Flores, an Associate Professor of Educational Linguistics at Penn's Graduate School of Education, also the primary investigator of the Philadelphia Bilingual Education Project. And after this short break, we'll be talking about language and the doctor's office and the hospital. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've just been talking about how Philadelphia city government and the city's public schools have been serving the 10% of Philadelphians who are non-English speakers. California has one of the most language-diverse populations in the country. So what kind of challenge does that present to physicians and hospitals when their patients can't communicate with them? While there is a federal law requiring translators, not all hospitals are in compliance. We asked Dr. Alicia Fernandez to join us. She is a primary care physician at Zuckerberg San Francisco General, also a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and her expertise is in healthcare disparities, including Latino health, immigrant health, and language barriers. Alicia Fernandez, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we're making the transition from Philadelphia to California. Just how language rich or language diverse is California?
California is one of the most linguistically diverse states in the country. And San Francisco, where I'm based, has over 180 languages represented in the school district. So our hospital provides interpretation in 100 languages.
In 100 languages. Now, for your practice, your primary care physician, looking at your patients, what's the range of languages that are spoken?
We see over 100 languages in the course of a month in our hospital. There's maybe 40 languages that come in more regularly. So it's really extraordinarily diverse.
I can only imagine. Now, do you have translators for everybody?
No, we provide interpretation. So translation is written material and interpretation is spoken. And so we provide spoken interpretation, verbal interpretation, for almost everybody. We have 40 languages represented in our within our own interpreters and our sort of associate interpreters, and then through the use of commercial phones, commercial language lines, we can provide interpretation for the rest. It's very unusual. It does happen sometimes. There are some Indonesian languages, for example. It does happen sometimes that we cannot find an interpreter, even using the commercial phone lines. But that's very unusual.
Now, there is a federal law. What does that require?
That requires sites such as all hospitals that receive federal monies, which all hospitals do because they take Medicare, to provide interpretation in so-called threshold languages. And those are languages in which there's a certain amount of the population living near you. So it's usually one language or two to five languages. In San Francisco, for example, Spanish, Russian, Cantonese, Mandarin, Tagalog are all threshold languages. So those are the ones that the law says you must provide language access services, be that interpretation or bilingual clinicians. On the other hand, because it's virtually impossible to deliver a good state-of-the-art or standard, even a medical care, without providing professional interpretation, we ask, we try to do that for all language barriers, all for all encounters.
I'm trying to imagine, though, like, let's say not an urban hospital like the one that you work at in San Francisco, but let's say a more rural hospital. Can they accommodate the language needs of their patients?
They should be able to via phones. I mean, there are several commercial vendors of interpreter services in which the clinician can call a phone number and then using a dual phone system, have the interpreter provide services. And we have to remember that about almost between 60 and 70% of the non-English language spoken in the United States is Spanish. Hmm. So I'm describing to you San Francisco is a huge outlier. In most parts of the country, it's really Spanish that's the second language, and they should really be able to provide that either through hiring interpreters or through a phone system.
And how much do patients or even physicians like yourself rely on family members to do this work?
We try to discourage that. And the reason for that is that family members and other untrained interpreters, so family members, staff, who are untrained as interpreters, these folks, with the best of intentions, make very serious mistakes. And it drops the quality of the medical care that we can give. So there have been a number of studies on these. They're called ad hoc interpreters. And what we find is that not only is it very difficult to do it, they lack the vocabulary and so on, but they can also sometimes add things or answer for the patient or leave things out. In one famous study run in a pediatrics clinic, the ad hoc interpreter, the family member interpreter, added, for example, what the doctor said to give the baby amoxicillin for an ear infection, and the interpreter adds, put it in the ears. Now, amoxicillin is a drug that goes into the mouth. It's an oral antibiotic. So these are the sorts of things that happen when you use family members or untrained staff as interpreters.
And how would
it's also worth pointing out that family members don't like interpreting, usually. They like being there as family members, and it's a huge responsibility to try to interpret.
Well, and I would also think that there are issues of privacy, and let's say a son or daughter is with their mom or dad, and oftentimes intimate things get talked about in a doctor's office that may not be appropriate for that adult child.
That's exactly right. And on top of that, we discourage, and some states have made illegal, the use of underage children, sort of teenagers, as interpreters. And this is a huge issue because very often kids, 12, 13-year-olds, are asked to serve as interpreters for their family members. And it's really not appropriate, both in terms of the quality of the interpretation that they can give, but more importantly, in terms of the psychological dynamic, where it's the kid who is saying, if we don't control your diabetes, we may need to amputate your leg. Mm. Or it's a kid who's saying, did you have pain with sexual activity? That's not appropriate. And so that is why some states and the American Academy of Pediatrics do not permit interpretation by a minor. And the Academy of Pediatrics has come out strongly against it, and in some states that's now law.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Alicia Fernandez. She is a primary care physician at Zuckerberg San Francisco General. She's also a professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. And we've been talking about language barriers when it comes to the doctor-patient relationship or the patient-hospital relationship. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, especially if this sounds familiar to you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I would think in almost all of these cases, even when a physician is relying on an interpreter, the physician doesn't really know word for word what is being said. Does that put you in a kind of a step down position?
Yes, it's really difficult. For example, while I speak Spanish, I don't speak Cantonese, and I have a lot of Cantonese-speaking patients, as do most of us in San Francisco. And it's really very difficult sometimes to feel, am I really understanding the patient's concerns? And have I given the patient enough room to express their concerns? Because with an interpreted interaction, you can end up focusing a lot on making sure the patient understands your instructions and not really focusing enough on giving the patient room to ask about what they want to ask about and really listening to them. So it's always a concern, particularly if you have a very ill patient or patient in the ER, are we really getting the story? And that's why it is so important to work with professional interpreters and to develop trust with those professional interpreters that you're really getting the story, that you really understand what's going on with the patient.
How much can you interpret through body language?
Right. Well, that would, but that's really you can try to do that, but that is really substandard. Mm-hmm. And in medicine, we say that 80% of the diagnosis is made through history and physical. So if somebody comes in with, say, acute abdominal pain, we really want to know the history. When did this start? What was the association with food, et cetera, et cetera? And in order to do that, we really need to work with a professional interpreter who really knows what they're doing, with whom we've developed a trusting relationship. So in our hospital, we have interpreters on staff. We also, in our clinics, use video interpretation, where where we call our interpreters. They show up on a video screen, computer monitor, and that can be really helpful to have a patient interview. And then sometimes we'll also ask, or we'll use a phone if it's a language that we don't provide in-house. So these are all options. And it can be very important to have these options so that, for example, if we're having a family meeting, chemotherapy, no chemotherapy, should we go for surgery, dangerous surgery or not dangerous surgery, it is important to be able to have really good interpreters there, particularly who can come to the meeting and help us really talk with our patients and their families.
Is an interpreter an advocate? And I asked that. I was talking with someone that works here at the station who did this work for some time and found over time they developed a relationship with the patient and felt that need, desire for advocacy. How do you view that?
You know, that's a great question. And I think different interpreters view it differently. What we have, I personally think it's very appropriate and, in fact, necessary for the interpreter to let us know if they think that the patient is really not understanding what we're saying. so that at the very least we understand that the interpreter thinks that they don't understand. I personally think it's fantastic when interpreters work as advocates. Other folks prefer for them to be more language conduits, you know, sort of like let's stick to interpretation. But I think that there is more the way the field is going is that there's more recognition that interpreters can play very important and appropriate role as advocates.
And I would think you'd have to be pretty highly trained because you were speaking in and interpreting or translating in a very specific medical kind of language.
That's exactly right. So it's not a question of being fluent in two languages. My daughter, as someone who grew up here but speaks Spanish at home, can tell you, 10 ways to say, did you brush your teeth and have you done your homework? Mm-hmm. But if she has to say, your spleen is swollen, she would struggle to find the word for spleen. And that's why it's not enough to simply hire bilingual staff. Interpretation is its own skill, and mm-hmm. it requires a very specific access to a very specific vocabulary.
Let me read a question from Ellen, who says, doctors tell patients to bring a family member to be a, quote, second set of ears during an appointment. How do we adapt that advice to the advice of not using the person you come with as an interpreter?
That's a great question. And what I say to the family member is, I'm so glad you're here. I'm going to call a professional interpreter because that's our policy. I'm going to put them on the video or however. And I'm so glad you're here because then you can help me listen well, but also you're here as the husband or you're here as the adult child, and I want to know what you have to think. And sometimes family members first say, oh, no, I can do it. But then I say, but when I put on the professional interpreter, they love it, and they love being able to be the family member, not because the family member has an important role, but not the interpreter.
But not the interpreter. What about things like, I'm assuming when there's miscommunication, whether it's in English or any English in another language, there are risks for misdiagnoses or errors or longer or shorter medical stays. Just how critical is this issue?
It's hugely important. Most of the hospitals that have very robust interpreter systems have them as a result of lawsuits that happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago or that are happening now. So there's, for example, a famous lawsuit that came out, I think, out of Florida, where a young man was brought to the hospital by his family, and they said they told the ER docs that he was intoxicado, and intoxicado in Spanish means poisoned, but the ER doc thought it meant didn't use an interpreter and thought it meant intoxicated, i.e. drunk. So the young man was ignored and his change in mental status was ignored. And unfortunately, he had an aneurysm in his brain and ended up dying. And that was a huge settlement and prompted the installation of interpreter services. So that speaks to two issues. One, the importance of really being able to understand. And two, a common problem is that many doctors speak some Spanish, and this results in what we call false fluency, which is that they think they understand more than they do. So to answer your questions, it is critical that we be able to get a good history, and it is critical that we not overestimate our own language skills.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Dr. Alicia Fernandez, for joining us today in Radio Time. Such an important issue.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And again, she's a primary care physician at Zuckerberg San Francisco General and a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. The third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we talked about language acquisition, translating, interpreting, and all that. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.